From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about a bill in the Utah legislature that would strengthen the state's hate crimes law. There is a hate crimes law on the books, but critics say it doesn't really do much. In fact, there hasn't been one successful prosecution using that law, and this at a time when hate crimes in the country are on the rise. So we're talking about the bill today with supporters and one critic who says the current law is good enough. We'll be right back.
Hi, it's Nicole Nixon from 45 Days. Every week, Julia Ritchie and I break down the latest news and bills coming out of the Utah legislative session. If you enjoy the podcast, you should sign up for the 45 Days newsletter. It's like our show, except it's an email and you read it. Let us send you email. Sign up at 45days.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. This afternoon, state senators are going to begin hearing a bill that would strengthen Utah's hate crimes law. Now, this is a big deal if you're a supporter of this, because for years now and for various reasons, supporters of the legislation have not even managed to get a hearing. Some conservative lawmakers have balked at the idea of providing too much extra protection for certain groups, which has often just meant the LGBTQ community. The LDS Church has also been reluctant to support any changes. A few years ago, they said they worried strengthening hate crimes legislation would upset what they called a careful balance between religious liberty and gay rights in Utah. But last month, the church announced it would not stand in the way of this new bill. They're not endorsing it necessarily, not opposing it either, and that may have laid the groundwork for what some say could be some success this time. This is a bill sponsored by West Valley Republican Senator Daniel Thatcher. It's Senate Bill 103, and here's basically what it does. It includes felony counts in the hate crimes law. Right now, it only accounts for misdemeanors, and it adds to the list of protected classes. So if someone is charged under the hate crimes law, there would be enhanced penalties for crimes targeted at people for their age, for their ancestry, their religion, their ethnicity. It includes gender identity, sexual orientation, sex. It includes crimes that are targeted against people who are homeless or disabled or elderly.
Join us this evening.
And there are others. So today in the program, we're going to be talking about the bill and its chances in this year's legislature. And we're going to begin with Sim Gill, who is the district attorney for Salt Lake County. He's been a supporter of this piece of legislation, and he's joining us here in the studio. And Sim Gill, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Doug.
So I want to begin, let's just start with what is a hate crime.
Right.
Because I think, and this is something you and I were just talking briefly before we went on the air about, what it is exactly. What is the general impression that people have as opposed to what it actually is? Give us a sense of it.
Sure. I think that there's a general sense that, all crimes are hate crimes and that we're doing something different or artificially creating some rights. I think that misses the point that when hate crime happens, for me, I sometimes define it, there are three victims. There is the intended target, the person that you're specifically targeting, because often chosen, not because of anything that they did, but because the perceived perception that they belong to a group or a particular organization. And so there's that immediate intentional targeting that occurs. But then something really unique happens, which is there is a secondary victimization that occurs of the community or group that person belongs to. And that secondary victimization is what I call the chill of terror that is communicated and often left unaccounted for. And then, of course, the third victim is all of us. When this crime happens, there is not the proportionality of accountability or justice that happens. So to illustrate a point, recently, there was the shooting that happened in Pittsburgh at the synagogue Tree of Life. Now, that's, several thousand, that's about 1,500 miles away. But our Jewish community here in Utah felt that terror, felt that hatred, felt a concern for that public safety. It's that secondary component. So one way to think about hate crime, it's criminal conduct plus bias equals hate crime. And the APA and the Anti-Defamation League, they've talked about the unique nature of what makes this, that added qualitative difference. And when you don't recognize that added qualitative difference, then you what you're communicating is to that community that's impacted that we don't see you, that you don't matter. And by actually proportionalizing punishment and accountability, we're actually starting to give a measure of justice for the full scope of the kind of conduct hate crime really is. And that is something that is often missed.
So I wanted to ask you about this this Lopez story. This was in December of 2018. A homeless man named Alan Dale Covington. He was homeless at the time. He walked into Lopez Tires on Main Street, Salt Lake City.
Yes.
He had with him this metal pole.
Yes.
And he said out loud that he was there to, quote, kill a Mexican.
Yeah.
And he proceeds then to beat Jose Lopez and his son Luis.
Yes.
Luis got severely injured in,
very
this,
brutal
in
attack.
This attack. Now, you were able to charge Mr. Covington with three felonies.
Yes.
Why isn't that enough?
Well, first of all, because the question is, when he goes out there and is initially engaged in the conduct the way that he is, hate crimes are message crimes. Their full force and effect is to communicate that terror. There was the Latino Hispanic community in Salt Lake, which was terrorized. They were worried that are they going to be victims in similar conduct and similar kind of behavior. And it is that additional element. But in Utah, the reason my office could do nothing with it is because our current hate crime statutes are not applicable to the more serious crimes, which is felony conduct.
Right.
And so when I was asked point blank, are you considering this for a hate crime? I said, absolutely not, because that wasn't even a logical, viable option for me to consider. And the insult to injury is that the statute that we do have is only applicable to misdemeanor offenses, which are minor offenses.
Yeah.
So the more serious the offense, the greater the terror, the absolutely no remedy in the state of Utah.
Why only applicable to misdemeanors, do you think?
So that is a great question. Because when you think about the nature of hate crime, the only answer that I have is that I don't think that there really was an intent by the legislature. Now, we can pat ourselves on the back and say, look, we joined the rest of the civilized states here because we have what we call a hate crime. But practically speaking, it is such a difficult statute. It has no value in an enforceable capacity for us as prosecutors, and we can only do it to misdemeanors. So, one, it's the lowest level of offenses, and two, the obstacles are so severe that it's not a usable statute for
us. Explain what you mean by that. It's super vague.
They're really vague, but the more important thing is what it really focuses on is that it says that in the state of Utah, whether you're being targeted racially or because you're being targeted because you're gay or because of your religious faith, etc., if you're Muslim trying to worship, it doesn't matter that there's a conduct of a crime that occurs, but then we have to show the specific intent that when you engage in that behavior, it was an intent to deprive you of a constitutionally protected right. And that additional element is so difficult for us as prosecutors, and it is so removed from the reality of what a hate crime is that prosecutors in the state of Utah do not use it because it is not workable. That's why, Doug, in the last 20 years, there has not been a successful hate crime prosecution at the state level. Only prosecutions that we've ever had have been tied to federal prosecutions, which recognize the true nature of hate crime. So as a practical result, the insult to injury is I cannot apply it to felonies. Two, I can only apply them to the minor offenses. And three, if I want to apply them, it is so impossible that it's unenforceable and unusable. And therefore, effectively, we do not have a hate crime statute in the state of Utah.
This new bill that's being heard today in the Senate, what does that do on the question of intent? Just by including these various groups, do you still have to is there still a measure of intent you have to prove, or is it just implied by the legislation?
So, for example, one of the things that we did was consciously, when we helped draft this several years ago, we wanted to move away from the language of hate crime, and we actually started to, we call it a victim targeting or victim selection bill, because that really captures the essence of it. You are, because of who you are perceived to be, because of your core identity, and you're being targeted and being selected for that. And if you are in the listed personal attributes that have been identified, then if you're being targeted for that and being selected for that, now that's important because...
But how do I know I'm being targeted for that? For example, if... Does there have to be Mr. Sure. Mr. Covington
yeah.
was quite clear, here to kill a Mexican.
That's right.
Now, does that have to be present when you use the hate crimes legislation, that there has to be social media language or language?
Well, there's certainly the context,
how do you decide that?
The context of the conduct itself, while you're engaging in that criminal behavior, will be able to be something we can notice up, and then the totality of the evidence that is presented to a jury or a judge beyond a reasonable doubt will be the burden that we have to meet. So for example, historically, we had this old case where we had an African-American young lady, student, who was being bullied, and racial epithets were being slurred, were being said at her. They started to beat her with snowballs, pushed her. And when this went up on appeal, the Supreme Court, the appellate court said, she certainly has been assaulted, but the specific intent to demonstrate that there was a desire to deny a constitutionally protected right is not been proven. Mm-hmm. And you can't, it's a specific intent, and identified that this was a racially motivated attack as articulated, but did not qualify as a hate crime. So now what we will have, this is what the new law allows us to do. First of all, it allows me to enhance misdemeanors, and it also allows me to apply it to all felonies within the sentencing scheme. So a third degree felony, which is generally punishable by 0 to 5 years, is now punishable by 1 to 5 years. A second degree felony, which is 1 to 15, is now punishable by 2 to 15. And it really starts to allow the totality of that conduct and the evidence of that to be brought into the underlying criminal behavior. So it opens up the full continuum of criminal conduct, not just some limited stuff. And for the first time as prosecutors, we can actually have a workable hate crime statute. It's not perfect, but it's opening the door where we can actually start seriously applying it.
Mr. Gill, why do you think this seems to be a possibility this time? I mean, one of the things that the bill sponsor, West Valley Republican Daniel Thatcher, said recently is that his fellow lawmakers in the past had been inherently uncomfortable with hate crimes legislation.
Yes.
Part of that, I imagine, had something to do with reluctance on the part of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day
right.
Saints. Talk a little bit about what changed. Why is it that the LDS Church, as I mentioned in January, decided to come out and say, we're not going to oppose it?
Right.
And in fact, we don't like being blamed for the fact that, that is what Marty Stevens, the church lobbyist, said.
Absolutely.
We're being blamed for this not happening, and we don't want that.
Well, this is something that, thank you, first of all, raising that. And let me really acknowledge how grateful I am to the LDS Church for coming forward and clarifying their position. We started to reach in, myself from my office started to reach in and had some informal meetings with the general counsel from the LDS Church, Lance Wickman, and we started to talk about this. And what I shared with him was I came to him, I said, I'm coming to you in different capacities. One, I'm coming to you as a man of color, born as an Indian, son of immigrants. I'm coming to you as the Salt Lake County District Attorney and as the Salt Lake City Prosecutor. And I'm coming to you a community of individuals who believe in religious freedoms. I am of the Sikh faith. I have friends who are Hindus. I have friends who are Muslims. And there is a palpable fear here. And hate crime legislation is stalling. And when we had the conversation, the original message was, we've taken in no position. And part of the conversation was recognizing that even your silence is then being misappropriated in a way that it is not your intent. Yeah. And since it is being appropriated by people to justify their either agenda or personal animus, then it is a disservice to the position that the church has taken. And it is essential for the leadership of the church to come out and clarify its position so it is no longer being misappropriated. And the generosity of their position really helped break that logjam. Because as through my conversations, it was pretty clear and evident to me that they cared about the totality of individuals who were coming here. When you think about the statistics, you think about it, the number one reason is based on race and ethnicity. The second is based on religion and worship. Third is on ancestry or LGBT issues. And we were focusing so hyperly on this issue of LGBT issue, we were forgetting that there's a large swath of individuals based on religious liberty and worship who were not getting a measure of justice. And their position clarifying, which is, I think, has been consistent, but misappropriated by individuals for either personal agendas or personal animus, really was the critical factor.
Do you think you understood what they meant when they said in 2016, when they were resisting the bill, saying that it was upsetting some sort of careful balance? Do you think you understood what they meant by that, and how has that been resolved?
I think that they wanted to take a more neutral position, and I don't want to speculate, but I know that their intent was to sort of find this balance and really say, let the legislature do what they wanted to do, that they were not taking a position. But I can absolutely assure you there were people in the legislature who took that position. I mean, we were presented with the option of saying, well, we'll give you a hate crime legislation if you take the LGBTQ individuals out of it. But that really misses the core issue of what we're trying to do with the totality of our citizens. So I think that position, their silence, was misappropriated by many people in the legislature for a whole host of reasons. And what I think we realized through the conversations that we had is that the church really needed to clarify its position. And its intent was not to deny that right to the citizens. When you think about a international church that proselytizes the world and the cultural diversity that's coming here, and it really needed to clarify. But that clarification, I think, was essential, because now people cannot hide behind that misappropriation, and they have to own their own agenda or animus separate from that and to be held accountable. And I think that's the critical piece.
Last month, federal prosecutors charged Mr. Covington. We were mentioning that Lopez case, 3 counts of federal hate crimes.
Yes.
So why not just let the feds do it? Why is it more important for the state itself to be involved in that?
You know, that's a great question. And so let me answer it this way, that the nature of hate crime is very granular. It happens in local communities with local law enforcement and local prosecutors.
It goes to that effect you were mentioning before.
This really tears away at the fabric of your lived space and shared space. And when those injuries are occurring there, we can look to the feds if we want to provide that measure of justice. But it's really the interaction of local law enforcement, local prosecutors, with the volume of these incidents that you have to be able to deliver that measure of justice as a service to your community. Take, for example, last year there were about 94 hate crimes in the state of Utah that were recorded, which, by the way, are very underreported when you think about it, both locally and nationally. There were not 94 federal prosecutions. There was only one. So there's 93 other victims who found no measure of justice. And the feds are not that solution. We need that solution at the local level, because that is where that interaction and that delivery of justice really happens, at the local level. And when you remove that option from local law enforcement and local prosecutors, we lose that connectivity with the community of citizens who are crying out for that measure of justice.
Let me ask you finally. So as you've said, now you've taken away the this wasn't your word, but I'll use it, the excuse that the LDS Church was opposed to it now, and lawmakers now have to be accountable on their own terms for supporting or not supporting this piece of legislation. I'm not sure if you're taking account, but what's your sense of the possibilities now for this piece of legislation? Well, any sense of it?
Well,
right,
first
now?
Of all, this is the farthest we've ever gone with this legislation. We came out of the committee. It came out of there unanimously. It is now going to be a time certain second reading at the Senate at 2:15 today. And if it passes through there, this is the furthest we've ever gone, at least certainly for the last 20 years that I've been working on it with different groups. This is the most most hopeful that we've ever been. And I think that if it comes out of the Senate,
Will it come out of the Senate?
I think we have. I'm very optimistic. I'm guardedly optimistic. It'll be interesting to see what the opposition will be. But if it comes out of the Senate, I am convinced that we have the votes at the House and the representative House there, and that we're going to be able to get it. And so today is the critical vote, because they'll circle back within 24 hours for the third reading, and it should go forward. So at 2:15, we'll know exactly where their faith and service to the community lies.
Sim Gill, District Attorney for Salt Lake County, joined us here in the studio. Thank you very
Thank
much
you.
For the time. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Support for KUER comes from the local and national businesses around the state that underwrite our programming. Shows like Morning Edition, Radio West, and All Things Considered. If your business or organization cares about the in-depth local news and fascinating conversations you can only find on public radio, team up with KUER. To learn more about becoming an underwriter, look for the support tab at KUER.org and click on Business Support.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about a bill in the Utah legislature that would strengthen the state's hate crimes law. There is a hate crimes law on the books. Critics, however, say it doesn't really do that much. There hasn't been one successful prosecution using the law. It's up in the Senate right now. It's Senate Bill 103. We're talking about it today. We had with us earlier Sim Gill, District Attorney for Salt Lake County. Joining us now on the program is LeVar Christensen. He's a lawyer and a former state representative. In fact, he helped write the existing hate crimes law, which was passed by the legislature and signed by Governor Huntsman in 2006. He's joining us on his phone. He's actually in Colorado right now. And LeVar Christensen, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you. I'm sorry I didn't get to hear the discussion thus far.
I'll see if I can summarize what it is that Sim Gill had to say. One of the things he is confused by and stymied by in terms of prosecuting crime, he says, is the fact that Utah's hate crimes law, it only includes misdemeanors. It doesn't include felonies. Maybe start there, LeVar Christensen. Why did you only include misdemeanors in the hate crimes legislation?
Because Sim's predecessors in law enforcement, they didn't ask for that and didn't feel that it was necessary, because it's generally conceded that all violent crimes are malicious and the escalating penalties are already provided. And so the felonies, first degree, second degree, third degree, they include all of those factors. But now, as we've looked at this, that is the legitimate focus of the day. But all we would have to do is add to the current law that we passed before one sentence. We could just say the court may also apply the same enhancements to felony offenses as the court may deem just and proper. But instead, in the political climate that we're in, they've now created 17 categories of special victims, and then creating a new statute, Section 14. And no, the legislators are being alerted to, because the statute doesn't reference the existing law, which is Section 203.3. So it's kind of out of context. So it's hard to have the full discussion, and it's therefore very appropriate that you're having this dialogue today. So again, we all are united. We're all united in wanting to appropriately address these terrible, terrible offenses. We want to do the right thing for the right reasons and in the right way. But there are some very sensitive constitutional issues and potential unintended consequences. So we want to get it right, and that's what this dialogue's all about.
What do you mean constitutional unintended consequences? What is it that you're worried about in terms of the constitutionality? I know you've expressed concern that this might jeopardize the separation of powers constitutionally.
Well, that's a very legitimate one, is the balance of powers. The courts aren't to legislate from the bench, but if this bill does pass, one of the most essential provisions in it is Section 4D, where it makes it clear that the section does not create a special or protected class for any purpose other than a criminal penalty enhancement under this section. That is vital, because if it were not for that, anytime you single out and try to define a specific class of people, rather than all men are created equal, and by doing that, you run the risk that anyone that's not on the list that you have to endlessly have for years to come, an endless succession of Me Too, Me Too, Me Too legislation, whereas currently the statute that we adopted, it encompasses all people. It affects everyone. It doesn't try to single out any particular group. Rather, it's malice towards none and charity towards all. And so with great compassion, it recognizes all people. And it makes sure that any crime that has the effect of terrorizing an individual or a community, causing anyone to fear the exercise of their constitutionally recognized rights, that would be prohibited. So I would respectfully submit that the current law is broader, more inclusive, more effective, and that all we need to do is add one sentence, as I mentioned, that would take it to the level of felonies, which the law enforcement people previously said and thought wasn't necessary or desired. But if it is now, that would just be a one-sentence addition, and you'd have a more broad and a more inclusive statute than the proposed legislation.
I'm sorry you couldn't hear Sim Gill earlier on the program. One of the things he said was that just changing it to a felony doesn't, in fact, fix it from his perspective in one sense. And he mentioned that right now it's virtually impossible to prove intent, that you have to prove an intent to deny them a constitutional right. And that was his contention, that makes it another reason why it's vague and impossible to prosecute.
It really is not that way, because it says that it has the effect of, and so the Supreme Court has said for years in balancing rights and powers is that you can't criminalize thought or expression, but you can and you should criminalize conduct. And so that's the delicate balance that they go towards. And so you don't try to create, they could decide, if he seems like he wants to create separate crimes, but instead they've always said that what they wanted was enhancements. They wanted aggravating factors. But many felt, the legislature before, as they said, how does hate differ from malice? It's the same. And so they've just tried to make sure that they're not, just because of our deep, 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 sincerely felt compassion for all people, and the trauma and the shock and the terror of these just egregious individual cases that keep arising that we can think of over the years, things that have been in the news just recently from year to year. But many can not know the law sufficiently, so they write another law or another statute. But again, the thing that's missing in the current statute is just that it was thought that previously that there was no need to address escalating felonies because of first degree, second degree, third degree, and with all of the existing law. But if Sim and others feel differently today, well, as I said, that all you'd have to do is amend the current law. But instead, when you read a statute as it's proposed at the legislature, those that know or, you know, experience looking at the bill, you'll see that the delineations, that's when you're amending a law, and then underline is when you're creating new language. But again, there's no reference to the existing law. Section 203.3 is nowhere to be found. Instead, the bill comes forward as Section 14 as a new standalone statute, and so it's presented out of context and as if we don't have anything, and so therefore we need this. And again, I echo with the greatest sympathy and sincerity and compassion that all of these individuals, we want to protect them. But I would respectfully submit that the current law is much more inclusive, much more effective. It just needs to maybe be elevated to the level of felony. There was no conscious desire to not do that before. That was just law enforcement's recommendations before. And if that's changed, then a one-sentence addition, the court may also apply such enhancements to felonies as the court deems just and proper. That would take existing law and provide the effect that they're looking for and be much more inclusive of all people.
Why do you figure there hasn't been one successful prosecution of the hate crimes law now on the books in 20 years?
That's what he always says, and it's only because they're aggravating factors. They're not standalone crimes. So there's been tons and tons of, sadly, murders, theft, trespass, assault, battery, everything you can think of. And so, but at the time, back 20 years ago, because of the goodness of the people of Utah, the only offense we had at the time was sadly an eighth grader on the way home from school that was being pelted with snowballs and racial slurs. That was the level of such offenses back then. So the crimes are there. It's just that they want to label them as hate crimes. But if you look at all of the malicious crimes, and that was the whole issue, is that do you need another law in the newspaper, in the media, when it's presented as if we don't have it, and therefore we need something new? But I echo, and we're 100% united in our love and concern and compassion for all people. And I believe that the law that we adopted is so inclusive that it reflects that genuine compassion, rather than trying to create 17 singled out groups and then just keep going from year to year as we add more to them.
One of the things you've said is that it's only being heard this time, or considered this time, based on emotional or political reasons. What do you say? It sounds like you're questioning the motives of someone trying to pass the legislation.
No, we're united in that. I just think that not everybody has the constitutional law background to know the full context in which it's submitted. I don't have strong feelings against it. I'm just trying to make sure that we do the right thing in the right way for the right reason, and that the dialogue is accurate, and that the legislators are able to be fully informed, so on behalf of the people, they can make sound decisions. I would respectfully disagree that we've never had a prosecution, and that we can't, and that we have an ineffective law. They're all integrated. They're all come together. I don't understand why, if they have those strong feelings, why don't they amend the existing, quote, hate crimes law, unquote, rather than go create a new section in isolation that doesn't fully inform all of the legislators as to where we are, how we got here, and what the merits are of what we're trying to do going forward. So it really just comes down to the special groups approach, which other states have done. But with the Supreme Court decisions and everything else, this has proven to be very inclusive, very sound, no unintended consequences. But again, if a very legitimate question is, perhaps it should be escalated to include felonies if the other offenses. I mean, Sim, I'm sure he has. I know he has. I've witnessed it. I do lots of pro bono defense work, and I've dealt with his office very respectfully. But I know that on a daily basis, they're prosecuting crimes of this nature at the felony level, whether they're singled out and called hate crimes or not. That's the dialogue they're having now. But nobody's being turned away, and we're not sanctioning or endorsing or tolerating these egregious crimes. And so it's a very worthy discussion that we can have.
Let me ask you quickly and finally, we're running out of time here. I just wanted to ask you what you make of the LDS Church's position on this, not coming out in direct opposition. They've been uncomfortable about making changes in the past, made it clear. Marty Stevens made it clear a few months ago that, in fact, they were not standing in the way. This seemed to have made some kind of difference. You know how it works up there. What do you make of all of that?
Well, they've always been neutral. The church never interferes, and all religions come forth, and they'll speak up when they feel that when freedom of religion and expression is, at risk, or religious liberty. But so I don't think this is unique. That was the same position they took previously when these measures were passed. I think, again, that Section 4D is critical in the new bill if it passes. That's the one that makes sure that there's no unintended constitutional consequences, that you're not using quote-unquote hate crimes to create new special classifications of citizens that would then ripple out and affect to other laws. That would be the balance of powers that would have the unintended consequence I was referring to. So that's very essential. That now leaves you with the narrow questions of yes or no, do you need to single out and address felonies? Yes or no, do you need to create 17 groups? Or can you protect all people, all communities? And I think if you look closely at Section 203.3 and simply heighten it to include felonies, I believe that would be a much more protective, inclusive outcome.
That's LeVar Christensen, former state representative, lawyer, joined us on the phone from Colorado. LeVar Christensen, grateful for your time today. Thank you very much.
Thank you to the people of Utah. I know that our outcome will be very sincere, compassionate, and effective. Thank you very, very much.
Thanks very much. Joining us now on the program is Brian Levin. He's a professor of criminal justice, the director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino. He specializes in the analysis of hate crimes and terrorism and legal issues. He's joining us from a studio at NPR member station KUCI in Irvine, California. And Professor, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I was going to sort of back into this conversation, but let's jump right into some of the things that were mentioned by former state lawmaker LeVar Christensen. First of all, give me a sense of what you're hearing, because I'm sure you're hearing these same kinds of arguments made all around the country about, you know, affording special protections to groups, the balance of power, it's unconstitutional. Start there, if you would.
I'm also an attorney, and I actually wrote two friend of the court briefs in the case that affirmed the constitutionality of hate crime laws. By the way, 9-0, every Supreme Court justice, including Reagan appointee, at least to the chief justiceship, William Rehnquist. So the constitutionality of penalty enhancement laws for hate crimes has been settled. So that's a total red herring. And if you don't believe me, just go Google Wisconsin versus Mitchell.
To the question of setting it, what are you hearing then from LeVar Christensen and other conservatives who oppose hate crimes legislation in states around the country? This idea that you're setting aside special exceptions for special groups, which often has just been a way of saying they don't want to add extra protections for gay people. What do you make of that part of this?
But it's not adding extra protection for gay people. If gay people went out and beat up straight people in great numbers, they'd be prosecuted too. And if they did, they should. But we don't see that. Bottom line is, the Supreme Court has already addressed this. And let me just talk about traditions with regard to criminal law, because I've taught that both at the college and law school level. The criminal law takes into account motive all the time.
Yeah.
So, for instance, manslaughter versus murder it involves motive.
Yeah.
If you unplug the life support of your uncle to spare that person pain, you'll be treated differently than if you did it for insurance proceeds. So the law punishes motive all the time. Also, with regard to different groups, each group is protected equally.
Yeah.
So the bottom line is, we don't punish drunk driving. And if you look at Utah, they got really tough recently making the most strict drunk driving laws in the country by having just amorphous reckless driving statutes. The bottom line is, as someone who knows the Constitution as well, the Supreme Court has consistently said that laws can be held unconstitutional because they're void for vagueness. So the more specific a law is, like this one is, the better. Also, it does not criminalize anything new. The Supreme Court specifically chose to approve an enhancement model. So, for instance, if you commit a crime and you intentionally select the victim of the crime because of their faith, for instance, because they're an LDS member, you rightly can get an enhanced sentence. And we do that all the time. Being disorderly on a street corner is differently than being disorderly on an airplane. So we have these distinctions all the time with respect to the criminal law making distinctions on things like motive, victim, offender, recidivism, all kinds of things. And this is a welcome step. The fact that the law was never used before is all the proof of the pudding.
Yeah.
It really is a terroristic threat statute rather than a hate crime statute that Utah currently has. Utah is one of our target states, and this is one of the things that Utah really should do. And can I just say one thing, though?
Sure.
Utah is a very special place. Over the years, I've had the opportunity to see Orrin Hatch, for instance, in action with regard to federal hate crime data collection and federal hate crime law. The bottom line is, Utah residents, because of the horrible history of violence and bigotry against the LDS Church, knows well the taste of bigotry, the violence that comes with it. And we need a particular law that puts people on notice, that specifically deters this kind of conduct, just like having a drunk driving law as opposed to a reckless driving law.
One of the things that you have mentioned that I think helped me understand this a bit is you mentioned that that in some ways we don't have general safety laws that cover arson. You have a law that specifically says this is arson. Now explain again. I think you were referring to this before, but explain why this is particularly important.
Well, because we have a qualitatively and quantitatively unique category of offenses with respect to hate crime. We know the different types of offenders, for instance. Mm-hmm. And the fact is we want to specifically deter this kind of conduct. And the bottom line is 45 states have hate crime laws. Nearly all of them are penalty enhancers. We have not had constitutional challenges. And by the way, let me just say one thing. Within the law that is proposed, it even protects free speech, which is not necessarily needed in the sense that the Supreme Court already protects free speech because they threw out a poorly drafted hate crime law the year before they affirmed the enhancement model. Bottom line is we have to specifically deter this particular type of conduct, and a law that sends a message out to would-be offenders that, yes, if you do target someone for violence because of their disability, because of their faith, their race, that Utah will take that extra step. One other quick thing.
Yeah.
It also defines on a moral plane what this wonderful state will accept and will not accept with regard to criminal conduct. And I will come up to the legislature anytime on our own dime to present the data, which shows, by the way, we just have a report coming out. Hate crimes in major American cities have risen for the fifth consecutive year, and religion hate crimes are again above 20%.
I want you to say a little bit more about that point. Hate crimes reported to police in your report in America's 10 largest cities rose 12.5%, the report says, in 2017. Fourth, as you say, consecutive annual rise. What's going on as you're looking? Any sense of what might be happening? What's this connected to as far as you can tell?
Well, we have a new report coming out for 2018, and what it shows is in the 30 cities that we looked at, decade highs were hit. The top four cities were up. The top 10, interestingly enough, were about flat. But overall, what we've been seeing nationally is a year-by-year increase in hate crime that we haven't seen since data collection has first started back in 92 nationally. So we are looking now at the fifth consecutive annual increase in 30 major American cities.
How connected to the political landscape is hate crimes as far as you can tell? And can you make any, I'm not sure if you can make any causal links, but any links that you can make towards the, you know, the sort of the tenor of the political conversation going on these days?
We are so polarized now that this has become an unfortunate symbol of a culture war. Yeah. But the bottom line is, for this, we have to protect our citizens. Every time I go to different states, people come up to me, disabled people, religious minorities, and tell me all kinds of horrible attacks. And the bottom line is the Bureau of Justice Statistics found the majority of victims do not report. A specific law sends a message to victims and prosecutors that this is a priority. And the fact that Utah has not been able to prosecute a single hate crime over the very amorphous existing law is pretty much all the news you need to hear.
Yeah. So I'm looking at the 2017 report. I want to know how it differs from 2018 in this sense. What are the things that you note in the 2017 report is that the most common types of hate crime bias categories were, in 2017, anti-Black, anti-Semitic, anti-gay, and anti-Latino, which when you compare the year before, it had changed in significant ways. It was anti-black, it looked like, but also anti-white. That was interesting. So how are the dimensions changing? How are these categories changing as far as you can tell now?
Really interesting. What we've found is the biggest increases in the cities that broke it down, that we actually compared, and we took 10 large ones.
Yeah.
Anti-white was up the most, and anti-Semitic was also up. Anti-gay was up, but up less. What we found is that about 41% involved race or ethnicity, and sexual orientation and religion were split at about 25% apiece, approximately.
How much is let me just be frank about it. How much is the rhetoric of President Trump contributing to all of this, as far as you can tell right now?
Well, that's a great question. We're nonpartisan, but let me tell you this, some interesting data that we have, and it's not as diagnostic or predictive as we like,
yeah.
But listen to this. When candidate Trump launched his campaign and spoke derisively against Mexicans, anti-Latino hate crimes in that couple of week period did not go up. However, around when he made his Muslim ban proposal, hate crimes surged above and beyond the level that it was from the terrorist attack in San Bernardino, which occurred 5 days before. Also, November 2016, according to FBI data, and also this is with our friends at West Virginia University, Jim Nolan over there, what we found was that November 2016, election month, listen to this, was the worst month for hate crime going back to the first anniversary of 9/11, September 2002, and November 10th, the day after the election, where we had an anti-Muslim bomb plot of an apartment complex. Mm. That was the highest day for hate crimes going back to June 2003. So it appears that sometimes when leaders make statements, particularly around emotional events like elections or terrorist attacks, that there is a correlation with regard to fluctuations in hate crime. One last point. Yeah. President Bush, 6 days after 9/11, spoke to the Islamic Center of D.C. Hate crimes dropped by two-thirds the next day and two-thirds the next year. That being said, even though anti-Latino hate crimes did not go up immediately after his campaign announcement, they did go up. They were the highest increase for that November spike, and they also went up significantly in 2016 as well.
I want to ask you about some specifics in the Utah legislation, the parts that you might like and the parts that you might not. We've talked a little bit about how this includes protections for age and familial status and homelessness and marital status. And some of these things, it seems you like. It sounds like you're not so fond of some others, like the inclusion of emergency responders in all of this. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, first of all, I used to be an emergency responder, a proud third-generation NYPD officer.
Right.
So I do believe that members of the armed forces and emergency responders should be protected. I just think it should be in another law,
okay,
because what this does, it clouds the more prejudiced stuff. One quick thing, though. Homeless people, National Coalition for the Homeless, of which I'm on the board of, they found that there were almost about double the hate homicides against homeless people. In other words, done by domiciled people without a pecuniary gain or drug deal or personal animus than all the other hate crime homicides combined during about a 19-year period.
Wow.
So the homelessness are brutalized. In Los Angeles, 10 were murdered last year. We really should include the homeless as well.
What about gender identity?
Absolutely. In fact, we're seeing that in our data, too. Unfortunately, there's been a string of murders, many of people of color, the majority, who are transgendered, yet we don't even have perps identified. So, yes, transgendered people should be covered. But let me say this. This does not mean that you have to agree with everything in every group that's represented, in the same way that you may not agree with everything about my faith. But we don't want people brutalizing folks because they're homeless or because they're LDS or Jewish or black. And that's what this law does. And it does cover everybody equally. Otherwise, it would be prone to 14th Amendment equal protection violations. Again, the Supreme Court has upheld this. And indeed, Chief Justice Rehnquist, during the oral argument, said, hey, It's up to the legislature to make these determinations. The bottom line is we need a statute of this type, and it's up to your legislature to decide who's covered. But this is a step in the right direction. One other thing, it covers associational crimes. Yeah. In other words, so if I'm dating an African-American and I'm beaten up, that's covered as well. Utah really should come into the fold with the rest of the country. We haven't had successful challenges against statutes that are well drafted like this.
How important is it in terms of setting a precedent for other states who might have been reluctant in their hate crimes legislation for this to pass in Utah, a conservative state like Utah?
It's very important. Let me tell you something. I love coming up to Utah. This is a state of independent thinkers who are conservative. Many, though, are people of faith and understand the brutal consequences of bigotry, particularly for a religion that had its genesis in some of the most horrible religious bigotry that this nation has ever seen. It's time that Utah steps up to the plate and protects all these categories, including religion. Absolutely.
South Carolina, Arkansas, you've mentioned there are others that you're watching. If Utah passes this, do you think that could be a sign, a positive sign in your perspective?
Yes, and I just signed a letter right when I was waiting to go on the show to urge Indiana. There are five states that don't have hate crime laws, including Georgia, Arkansas, Wyoming, Indiana, South Carolina, Georgia. But there are only about 30-some-odd states that cover, for instance, disability, gender identity, sexual orientation, and we need those states to add them as well. Utah will be a shining star that recognizes that even among conservatives, there are certain values we have that the ability to have individual liberties, to live our lives as we choose, associate with who we choose, pray to who we choose, and also if we're disabled, to be full members of our society. This is really important. And I thank the prosecutor and the folks who are proposing this bill, particularly Mr. Thatcher. And I am ready, willing, and able to demonstrate what the law is and the data, the latest data that we have, anytime that Utah wants me up there, at our cost, by the way.
It's Brian Levin. He's a professor of criminology and the director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino. Joined us from a studio at NPR station KUCI in Irvine, California. Professor, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you so much for this opportunity. It's really important that Utah residents really look at the facts with this. I think they'll come up on the right side of the fence.
Radio West, production of KUER News. Technical direction from Michael Havey today. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.